You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
In this month's episode, we are very honored to have David Rankin, author of the Grimoire Encyclopedia, return to the podcast to discuss his latest book, Clavis Intelligentarum, a complete practical manual of conjuration of the planetary intelligences. Utilizing his extensive practical knowledge, honed over four decades of practice, David has brought together a text which guides the aspiring Solomonic magician through the process of conjuration of the seven planetary intelligences, as first outlined by Cornelius Agrippa in his three books of occult philosophy. In this episode, we discuss David's inspiration for creating the book, how he approached the work of the modern grimoire revivalist in synthesizing a historically attested and complete process for the conjuration, the nature of the intelligences and the manner in which their seals are produced, as well as David being the first person to publish the corrected seals of these spirits since they were first printed some 500 years ago. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome David Rankin back to the Hadean Press podcast. David, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Matt.
I should start by saying congratulations on becoming part of the Hadean team. Editor-in-chief is pretty awesome. You've been very busy for this past year, and you've even found time to write another book. But could you tell us about what else has been going on in your life since the last time we spoke?
I suppose the big thing really was moving to Spain. That's been quite a big life change, and you know, adjusting to a very different lifestyle and the heat. Apart from that, it's you know just the joy of you know, watching my daughter move into being like a toddler who does all the things that toddlers do and you know, needs fairly constant attention. And you know, then in my time when she's asleep, fitting in the editing and writing work.
Yeah, and you've done quite a lot in that time. Really excited to talk about that. So your book, which you about to put out soon, the Clavis Intelligentarium is a, well, how would you describe it? It's a like a blueprint for creating one's own grimoire based on the planetary intelligences.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote it as like a manual because, you know, grimoires, it's not really a grimoire because, you know, grimoires were people's personal notebooks. This was designed as a manual of everything you need to know, the whole system, like you say, a blueprint, trying to not leave anything out so that someone who's got no experience of conjuration can work through the material in it and feel confident to do a conjuration of the intelligences.
So you mention at the beginning of the book that you are operating under some very specific parameters. And yeah, I'd just like to ask, could you explain why you choose to use this form of procedure for the operations themselves?
Well, I mean, I wanted to keep it within the Solomonic framework. I mean, it's basically how I have done it. And then trying to put in all the little considerations and things that people might not think of if they haven't done it before. So it's like my sequence explained explaining what stuff is, why I do it, where it comes from, and how it's been synthesized together. And also sort of clarifying that because the intelligences first turn up in Agrippa, that I'm working them within the classical grimoire framework. So it's working with that hierarchy of the archangels above the intelligences. And so it's like the Judeo-Christian cosmology. That's the structure that they're found within. So that's how I've worked over the years. I've done other stuff that isn't in that structure, but I wanted this to be a manual of how I've done it and had repeated success, and that hopefully other people will be able to, do the same through working through the sort of different stages that are required. Yeah, I mean, it's very much influenced by, for example, consecrations from things like the Key of Solomon. There's a lot of that. It is very much Solomonic in style, so.
So Solomonic would be a more accurate way of describing.
Yeah, so it's more Key of Solomon, Heptameron influence on it, that, for example, and bits from other grimoires than Agrippa. Because, I mean, Agrippa only really mentions the intelligences, he doesn't give a lot about them.
Yeah, I was about to say he doesn't actually give a procedure in the three books of how to use them. They're just sort of laid out with some explanation.
Yeah, I mean, the only place that gives that is in Sloane 3821, which I did that pamphlet of a few years back for Hadean. And so that's the place, the main source, really. It's where the conjurations are and the most information about their qualities and what to work with them for.
So, what was your inspiration then to put this together?
Well, last year, Stephen Skinner and I were asked by an Italian group, the Sulphur Society, if we could give a lecture each. They were running a course which was going to end with the people on the course doing the conjuration. And due to timings, Stephen went first and then I went after him. So we discussed with the people in the society, and Stephen and I both felt the intelligences would be the best thing for these people who hadn't done a conjuration before. So Stephen went through all the theory with them, and I went through all the practice and what they needed to do. And as I was putting the practice material together for them, the words of Jason Miller came into my head from the review he did on his blog of the Grimoire Encyclopedia, where he commented on the chapter I wrote about practice, saying, "This is Rankin the Conjurer, a voice, frankly, we don't hear enough of." And at that point, I suddenly realized that I've been saying to people for years, plant intelligence, great place to start if you can do conjuration. Then I thought, but those conjurations are there without all the surrounding framework of what to do. So in a sense, I'm giving people empty advice. So I need to rectify that mistake, because I stand by that it's a great entry point, but there's no point in me saying to people, start with the intelligences, if they don't have anything to start with apart from a conjuration, without knowing the circle to use, the preparations they should be doing, and everything else. So I thought, right, I'm going to expand on this material that I've been putting together for the Sulphur Society and create a manual of everything. Because I'm not really aware of anyone having done a book that has absolutely everything, laid out. No, there's no hints or you should maybe do this, or like trying to build mystical. It's just plain and bare. This is everything you need to do. This is why you do it. This is how you do it. And so, yeah, that was the process. It just came together of like, yeah, I need to do this, because it ref otherwise it reflects badly on me that I'm giving advice that's ineffective, and I don't want to do that.
Why is it that you think that the planetary intelligences are a great place to start for most people who are interested in developing a grimoiric practice?
Well, they're described as being courteous and affable and benevolent. They're quite friendly spirits. They're quite easy to get along with. And I think they're easier to access. And so from that perspective, for your first spirit, you want something that is not tricky, like demons can be, and that you can engage with in a sort of nice, easy way that you're comfortable. And also, intelligence is extremely effective spirits, at what they do. At the end of the day, you might find you're working with intelligences you don't need to be going off and working with, like, of angels and demons, and that you can achieve the things you need to with the intelligences. Some people, there's this sort of obsession of, like, people think they need to work with all these different types of spirits and everything, but it's actually, at the end of the day, not really necessary. One thing with the intelligences that turns up in that's mentioned in the Grimoire as well is that, for example, you can get familiar spirits from the intelligences. So that's something that I put in the book on the process for that as well. It's like, how to work that. So yeah, the intelligences have an awful lot to offer, and I think they're the most, like I say, accessible and easiest entry point and most positive entry point for doing conjuration.
So you would say that working with these spirits is far far simpler and more beneficial than, say, working with something like, say, I don't know, the Grimoire Inverum or the Ars Goetia.
Yeah, definitely. There's not that much required in the way of tools, for example. It's the process is a sort of quite clean, simple process. I think there's an elegance to the intelligences as well, in the way they engage with you, which, as I say, I think makes for a very positive relationship. And so I do think that they make a lot more sense as an entry point. And as I say, you might find that you don't actually need to go off or work with others. Nothing against, the spirits of the Verum or the Ars Goetia or what have you, but I don't think that's necessarily the best place to start. I think it's a good place to move on to, but I think it's good to start with a solid structure which you can then build on, rather than jumping into something like the Ars Goetia, which, if you look at it, that there's the whole coercive side of it, which, I never actually found the need for when I've done goetic stuff. But there's a different mindset to it, and I think the mindset of working with intelligences is very constructive and forward moving, and it takes away. Also, I think that for a lot of people, there's this idea of stuff like the Carusha and the Verum being dark and edgy, and conjuration isn't about being dark and edgy. It's about achieving things through working with the spirits and about increasing your personal knowledge, working towards, becoming better at the things you do.
So, as these are planetary intelligences, is it necessary for somebody to have at least a passing familiarity with, say, astrology?
It helps from the point of view of the timings. I do talk about the timings and obviously you're working on the planetary days and the planetary hours, but I also make suggestions about looking at the relationships between planets and, looking, doing, casting a chart, which the software is available online free to do, for the timing of when you're planning on doing it, to make sure there aren't, negative aspects, because, there's the whole relationships to planets that some are friendly, some are hostile, and you don't want there to be, lots of bad negative aspects between hostile planets and the planet you're working with, which, can have a detrimental effect on the magical momentum. Everything in the way I have put the material together in the book is geared to create the maximum magical momentum for the conjuration, so you have the maximum chance of success. So, yes, it's good to have at least a passing knowledge of astrology and the qualities and relationships of the planets.
So you mentioned that as there was no source for the complete process of the conjurations of these intelligences in Agrippa, that you did what is essentially the necessary work of the modern grimoire revivalist and created a synthesis of your own, which is the foundation of your book. And yeah, I would love to hear a little about how you went about this, you know, as advice to those who are perhaps frustrated when they struggle to fit all the pieces of the jigsaw together.
Yeah, I've been doing conjuration for 42, 43 years now. And so obviously I've done quite a lot in that time. And for this, it was looking at all of the essential components. You need a magic circle. There isn't a specific one given, so I created a simple one. Single band magic circles with the names in are the most common, so that I went with that option. And with those divine names with pentagrams between, fairly classic type of magic circle, not one you'll find in grimoires, but it's exactly the same style.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Use the triangle from the Grisha because it's a really nice structure, and also realize, you know, there's some insights I had into the nature of the triangle and the names on it in the book, which show kind of why it's such a good triangle. Consecration, I mean, that's a really big deal. You know, like everything should be consecrated in your magic circle. So I go into that in great deal and give consecration to everything, including ones that you don't find anywhere in the grimoires. So,
From personal experience.
yeah, I mean, I've looked for all the grimoires. For example, there is no consecration of your of the censer stroke oil burner in any grimoire. So I created one, and I used a particular biblical quote that I really like, which is something that's mentioned in the fourth book, you know, that you should adapt stuff yourself and to take stuff from the Bible, which is exactly what I did. Or the robe there isn't one for, so I adapted the consecration of the silk from the Key of Solomon into a robe consecration. Because, as I say, everything in the magic circle should be consecrated as part of the process of purification. The preparation tends to be fairly standard. You know, you have the issues of hygiene, of bathing, of prayer, etc., of fasting. So those, you know, they run through pretty much all the grimoires. It's quite easy to put that together. It was just a case of putting together all the pieces and then expanding on it and trying to qualify why all those things are there, why you do them, what's the purpose of them. And, you know, I have referenced everything, like for any consecrations I give, saying this comes from this particular text, this comes from this. I mean, the majority come from the Key of Solomon, but not all of them. For example, the consecration of the sword in the Key of Solomon is really short. And I use one from De Nigromancia with sort of minor modification because it's got much more oomph to it. And the sword is such a major thing. I think it deserves to have a really good consecration.
Yes, it definitely has more gravitas. Yeah,
Yeah,
I agree.
exactly. So, yeah, it's just a case of, you know, using my experience of conjurations from different grimoires to take all those essentials and put it together in the most simple and effective way, because, you know, the intelligence is it's simple and effective conjuration. So I don't believe in making things more complicated than they need to be. It's like, so it's stripped down from the point of view of only having the essential tools. I don't see the point in having stuff there that doesn't need to be there. And the book is written very much from the style of this is what you need, this is what you need to do with it, this is how you do it, this is why you do it.
And the reason I mentioned at the beginning that I thought it was a really good blueprint for the creation of a grimoire is of a personal grimoire is that I can see that that's the way that this book is going to be used in the future, because I see it as that stripped down, basic, like bare bones yet functional document that you can then launch from and produce something that's very uniquely your own. And I think that's really important.
I kind of say that, but this is not just for the intelligences. You can easily adapt it for working with other spirits, with angels and demons, but it does give a blueprint of all the key things. And at the end of the day, like I said, those grimoires, by and large, they were people's personal notebooks that they'd recorded stuff in, so there's large gaps missing. With this, you can fill in the gaps. You know, obviously, you're working with Grimoire X, then you take the magic circle from Grimoire X, not the one that is in the book. It might have different consecrations for some of the tools, so you replace those in, but where there's other stuff there, like the robe and things, that the consecration won't be in the grimoire, those things are there ready for you to use. So yeah, I'd say it's very much done as a blueprint that people can draw from. And you know, that's something when I like do the course I'm going to run will be kind of like the essence of that, that we'll work through that, but then also look at how that can be expanded into working with the Olympics, with angels and demons.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. So I think that it has a lot to offer people in the future in that regard, especially people who are just getting into magic. And it's a nice launch pad for people to develop their own sort of idiosyncratic practices and develop things. Also, like you said, you've provided a circle which is... It has been, you've logically constructed that from all your decades of experience and after reading so many different grimoires and seeing the manner in which the circle is produced. And so it sort of teaches through example how somebody could create their own unique circle and using the same techniques and the same technology. So yeah, so in that regard, I think it's a really fantastic book. And I think it's going to be absolutely fantastic. People are going to love it when they get their hands on it. So let's change gear a little bit, because I want to talk about something I think is going to be maybe the main point of conversation around this book, which is the sigils of the planetary intelligences themselves. So first up, can you explain the process of how these sigils are meant to be formed?
Okay, so they're meant to be formed using a system known as Eigbecher. Eigbecher takes its name from Hebrew letters. If you take a 3x3 square and go left to right across, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, then in one goes the Hebrew letters that have, because every Hebrew letter has a numeration, that have a numeration starting in one. So Aleph, A, 1, Yod, I, 10, Quaf, Q, 100. And next one, you know, Bet, B, 2, Kaf, K, 20, Resh, R, 200. And hence Eigbecher, that's where the name of the system comes from. So the sigils are formed by using the appropriate cameo or magic square of the planet, which is a number square where every horizontal, vertical line and diagonal add up to the same number. And you plot the numeration of the letters of the name onto the cameo and then connect them. So you start a little circle, then you draw a line to the square of the next one in. Now, obviously, the biggest cameo is 9x9, so it's only going to go up to 81. So a lot of the letters have numeration higher than is in the square. So from that perspective, you then, with Eigbecher, you drop any extra zeros off the end and use that number. So for example, we take, start with Agil, it's a 3x3 square of Saturn. So it only goes from 1 to 9. So the I, the Yod, which is a 10, you drop the 0 and it becomes a 1. the lamed at the end of it is a 30. You drop the zero, it becomes a three. However, if you were making, or for say, tyrial, the mercurial one, which would be on an 8x8, that lamed, there is a 30 in because it goes up to 64. So you don't drop the zero because that number is in there. So it's, you plot the sigil by connecting the numbers of the letters. And any, like I say, that the number is too high, you drop a zero off the end until it's not. So it might be you have to drop two zeros. Well, shin 300, you might have to be dropped down to three rather than 30. And then you have your sigil. However, what Agrippa did, which I assume is going to be the next thing, is at times he dropped numbers when he didn't need to. So he made a lamed, a three instead of a 30 in squares where the 30 was. And he also had a habit for about half of the intelligences. Most of the intelligence names end in IAL. And the I and the A, instead of having 10 and 1, he would combine them into 11. So instead of it going, let's say, from 3 to 10 to 1 to 30, he goes 3, 11, 30. But he doesn't do that for all of them. For some of them, he does keep the I and the A separate. He's not consistent. So as a result, none of them, by the rules of that system, none of those sigils are actually keeping to that strictly. So they're all incorrect by the rules of Aitbecker.
So, do you think that that was deliberately done, or was that simply just a mistake on Agrippa's part?
It's possible it was a blind and he expected people to realize. Because obviously, I mean, he was in that age where we have to go, there's this magic stuff, but of course, we don't do it, or we only do it in the most pure Christian way. So it's possible that he did put them in as a blind in that way. And as time went by, of course, because it was Agrippa, nobody questioned it. So if we've had 500 years of everyone just reproducing it without actually questioning the formation of the sigils of the intelligences.
So I think when I was a lot younger, I tried to do it. I tried to replicate them and I couldn't do it. And I thought I was just making a mistake. And I was like, yeah, I've just botched this. I don't think I'm clever enough to do it, and probably just put it down and never looked at it again. But what was it that cued you to realize that no, this isn't just that I'm making a mistake, this is actually just wrong.
It was in 2008. I was going to do a conjuration of Tyrael, and I didn't have the sigil to hand, but I had the cameos. I thought, oh, it's all right. I'll just draw it up. I don't need to go and find it. I can just reproduce it. And I did. And then when I got it, a book with it in, and looked, I went, they're not the same. And then I looked at it again, and I double checked my work, and was like, I followed the system. He hasn't. I looked at the evidence like, oh, and that's wrong on that one, and that's wrong on that one, and they're all. And I actually wrote a piece about it. I wrote an essay that went in the anthology, and the conjuration went perfectly fine with the corrected sigil. And then I forgot about it. And I mean, since then I've done conjurations using the Agrippa sigils because for some reason, popped out of my head. Then, when I was writing this book, in my dreams, I told myself, you need to go back and get that essay and put in about the fact that the sigils are wrong. Because I have this process when I'm working on a book I'm passionate about, I tend to get kind of obsessed about it. My unconscious edits and does stuff in my sleep. And sometimes wake up and been like having to rush off and change text and add bits in and stuff. And so it's like, I myself told myself I needed to look that up and went back to it. It's like, oh yeah, that needs to go in.
Yeah, I've done the same thing. I've woken up with gematria in my head when I'm deep in that. Why do you think it took 500 years for somebody to really notice it and make a fuss about, you know, like you're doing right now, you know, to say, hey, everyone, look, you know, we need to make sure that the sigils are actually correct.
I think it's because Agrippa was such a key figure that nobody questioned his work. You know, it's kind of, and I think there's an important lesson in there about no matter how big a name somebody is, you should still always test the veracity, the solidity of the system of their stuff for yourself, and make sure that it does hold true and that mistakes haven't crept in. You know, we're all human, you know, so. It was either a mistake or a blind by him, but either way, you know, it's just a reminder to actually to check stuff and not just accept things and take them for granted. What's really interesting is the fact that it still worked for people. And my theory on that is that if people were putting everything else in place in a way to do the conjurations, that they generated enough magical momentum that the intelligence has accepted those as the contact. You know, I have this analogy which I mentioned elsewhere. When you're doing conjuration, like the conjurations are like the ringing of a phone. Your crystal is like the phone, and the seal, the sigil you put underneath, is like the phone number. And it's like Agrippa changed the phone numbers, but they got used so much that they became an accepted phone number for those spirits. Because people were only contacting them through that. So if people were putting in all the purifications and consecrations and preparation and doing the conjurations, they generated enough magical momentum for the conjuration to still work, even though it wasn't quite the right sigil. And that, you know, that those spirits accepted that as another sigil.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Sigil that worked for them. Because who's to say that a spirit only has to have one sigil? They can have more than one way to contact them. So I think what happened is even if it wasn't initially the one by the system, it's still one that the spirits accept as a viable phone number for them, if you like.
So I was going to bring this up with you as well because I think Jake mentions in Night School book one, he makes a point of including the 18th aphorism from the Arbitel, and I'll just read it for the listeners so they understand exactly what that means. But the aphorism reads. There are other names of the Olympic spirits delivered by others, but they only are effectual, which are delivered to anyone by the spirit, the revealer, visible or invisible, and they are delivered to everyone as they are predestined. Therefore, they are called constellations, and they seldom have any efficiency above 140 years. Therefore, it is most safe for the young practitioners of art that they work by the offices of the spirits alone, without their names, and if they are preordained to attain the art of magic, the other parts of the art will offer themselves unto them of their own accord. Pray, therefore, for a constant faith, and God will bring to pass all things in due season. So to boil that down quickly, the idea being that the somebody who is working with these spirits, in this case, the Olympic spirits that are mentioned here, or with the planetary intelligences, as you mentioned in your book, it may be enough to only know the office of the spirit, not its name, and not its seal. And that if everything is done correctly, if the processes are done correctly, the consecrations are done correctly, the whole procedure is followed fully, that just by doing that alone, you will make contact with these spirits. Considering that, what do you think? What do you think about this aphorism 18 in regard to this specific instance?
Well, that then makes you wonder, perhaps those sigils that Agrippa gives are the ones that the intelligences gave him, and that rather than, you know, him getting them wrong, they are actually him reproducing the ones that he was given. So it is a possibility. Likewise, it kind of emphasizes my point about magical momentum, that, you know, if you do enough of all the other things, you can still get the result.
So we mentioned that, like you say, Agrippa may have worked with these spirits, and they may have corrected his sigils so that they became the sigils that we have known for the past 500 years. But where do these intelligences come from? We know that Agrippa essentially was codifying and taking all these different concepts from all these different authors across the medieval world, and synthesizing his own interpretation of magic. But where do you think that he actually got these planetary intelligences from?
That's a good question, because those names don't turn up anywhere beforehand. However, we go back to antiquity, and in ancient Greece, there is talk about intelligences, and there is talk about, you know, the sort of planetary stuff in the sort of the Arabic development from the ancient Greek. So I think that it's possible that he, even material that has been lost, or he was working from other things like possibly the Picatrix or something, and got these set of names and things from it.
I like to think that perhaps he had access to some now lost document in Trithemius's library, and maybe he had some access there to something that's now since been gone.
Yeah, I mean, not everything that's in that library, you know, that's referenced, for example, you know, in the Antipolis Maleficarum, we don't know where everything from there is. Some of it's lost, so who knows what might be in there, and some of that is planetary stuff.
Mm-hmm. I do like the idea of it being Greek in origin, though. That's very cool. I like that.
I mean, I do mention a little bit about intelligences and the Greek connection in the book as well. That might have been added in since the part you saw, because, you know, you were sent a copy, I think, before I added in a few extra bits and pieces. You know, it's really difficult to let go, you know, when you finish writing a book and you're like, oh, this bit could actually go in there nicely, or does this, you know, add something to it, or...
Yeah, yeah.
I think I might have quoted Proclus. It was Proclus or Plato. I can't remember now off the top of my head, but, you know, talking about intelligences, Proclus, in his discussion of intelligences, stated, every intelligence has its existence, its potency, and its activity in eternity. For if every intelligence has its existence established in eternity, and with its existence, its activity, each one will know all relevant things simultaneously, which gives a pretty good idea of why you would work with an intelligence.
Interesting. Yeah, I love that. The idea that the names of the spirits are themselves just epithets, and that, like, the seals are temporary, is something I think we should spend some more time considering. But I know that the seals that you are working with from Agrippa have a very specific method of formulation, so it doesn't matter who forms them or when in history they are formed, because the rules of Ike Becker are the same for everybody, no matter what. But yes, it's still possible to acquire unique sigils outside of that system through the spirits. Yeah, and it's interesting to see how, despite them being, you know, quote unquote incorrect for all of this time, that, you know, like for the last 500 years, that people have still essentially had success working with them. I'm very interested to see how that develops
now, you know, that you've actually presented these the corrected versions in your book. So yeah, I'm really interested to seeing if there's any massive changes in that regard, you know. So for our listeners that perhaps aren't familiar with these specific spirits that we've been discussing, each planet is assigned an intelligence and a spirit. That is, except for the moon, which also has an intelligence of intelligences. So yeah, I'd love to just pick your brain for a minute about this little tidbit of strange esoteric lore. So David, why do you think that the moon is special in this regard?
I mean, the obvious thing of the moon, in a sense, getting this when the others don't, is that the intelligences are working in a sublunar manner, so it makes sense for that. And it's interesting that when you get to sort of the actual conjurations and things, it just gets called Malka. It doesn't have the whole long name.
So the full name is Malka Betarsisim.
Yes.
I think I'm pronouncing that correctly.
But it's just conjured as Malka. And I just gave the sigil for Malka because I've done it as Malka and it works fine.
Agrippa gives two, doesn't he? He gives Malka and the second name side by side. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, I think it's Hashmadai, if I remember correctly, as the other one. But then in the set of conjurations that are in Stone 3821, it's just Malka is given. That's what I went with because that's what actually has, the conjuration there.
So, do you think that that name specifically could be an example of two previous spirits being joined together, much like Aglaurept and Tachimake from the Gamorrean Verum?
I do think it is a definite possibility, yeah. Either that or it's that's what even like a title type thing.
Okay.
I think Malka is really the key name part there of it. But because it's intelligence of intelligences, so it's like it's given like almost a seniority by implication that the second part is actually kind of referring to it being the of intelligences.
It was always something that I found very fascinating. And like you said, the moon has a specific quality to it, which the other classical planets maybe don't have, which is that it acts as a gateway from the terrestrial or the sublunar sphere to the rest of the cosmos. So when we're dealing with these spirits specifically, I mean, you've already mentioned the sublunar aspect, but are these intelligences specifically operating within the sublunar, or are we dealing with celestial intelligence, celestial angelic spirits?
I think this is part of the charm of the intelligences that they kind of connect through both. I think they're accessible in that sublunar manner, but are more celestial of nature. And that is why you have the archangels above them in the hierarchy, and then them, and then the planetary spirit or demon. In the planet, I would say the planetary spirit is, in a sense, fully sublunar quality. And the planetary intelligence is kind of like the liminal gateway between sublunar and celestial. And then you have the archangels at the celestial.
I think it was many years ago, but I read someone describing the relationship between the intelligence and the spirit as being similar to how Dr. Rudd would conjure an angel to bind a demon using the thwarting method. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, although I tend to think of it more as acting as a lens to focus the energy, and it's like the energy of the planetary spirit or planetary demon is more, it's more raw and amoral, and the planetary intelligence acts as a lens. So that's sort of like like a prism, or like focusing that energy, so it's more like a laser rather than diffused light. I think of it more as an overseer rather than, this sort of thwarting, controlling. Sometimes you need something to be the focus or the lens. And I think very much with their qualities, and like I say, seeing them as that sort of liminal role that intelligences have, is acting more as a lens for the energy of the planetary spirits, if you choose to. I think you can work the intelligences without the spirits, and this book is just the intelligences. I mean, the planetary spirits, very good to work with intelligences, for example, talismanic work, for adding extra power. But at the same time, I also talk about how in the book you can, for example, put a talisman under the seal in the triangle and get your intelligence to charge it up when you're conjuring it, give them another job to do.
So they're very much the intelligences themselves are very much what's the best word I would use? Intermediary.
Yeah, I think they are, in a sense, like the planetary intermediaries, very much. And as a result, another reason why they're very good to work with.
Okay, so could you describe to the listeners then exactly what is necessary to perform this? So we've talked a few things. You've mentioned already, like, there's a circle, there's a triangle. But when we're performing this kind of stripped down Solomonic magic, what are the absolute bare necessities? And for instance, like, why is purification so important? And, like, do I really need to wear specific, cleaned clothes, like robes, and have a very specific kind of incense? What could you describe something more about that?
Yeah, for a start, spirits are very sensitive to smell. They like nice smells, they don't like unpleasant smells. So they don't like dirty people. They don't like people who aren't clean physically. It's unattractive to them. You're less inclined to want to spend time around a stinky, sweaty, smelly person, whether you're a spirit or a human. So from that perspective, physical cleanliness is like a prerequisite, hence that part of the preparation. Likewise, fragrances are appealing to them. You are creating a more hospitable environment to invite them into when you're doing the conjuration. It's like the same as if you have a guest over to your house, you'll normally tidy up and hoover.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Clean up before the guest comes. You don't want them to come in and find your place an absolute tip. The same principles with spirits. You want them to come into a nice, clean, prepared space. The process of consecration of everything and your purifications, the bathing, the prayers, etc., the fasting, it's all part of the process of focusing yourself, getting yourself into the absolute best mindset to do the conjuration, where all your attention is wrapped up in doing that conjuration without any other distractions. You've like refined and refined and refined, like the alchemist, to get the gold of your conjuration. And so, all the consecrations, appropriate fragrance, circle, triangle, fasting, electronic fasting in this day and age. I'm very big on, like, absolute minimum of only answering emails you need to, like no social media, no YouTube and TikTok, no gaming, nothing that's distracting and dispersing your mental faculties. Trying to minimize social contact as well during that time. The other aspects of fasting, like with the not eating meat and fish and things, which are to try and help you be more sensitive. Likewise with the no sex, alcohol, drugs. The not eating only comes in towards the end of the fasting. Because if you ever try doing a week on just water, by the end of it, you're completely spaced and forget it. You're not in a state to do a conjuration.
I think 3 days is great for me, and I begin with I phase food through, I phase through food, so it's I have a very small breakfast. And then I don't eat lunch, and then I have like a soup or something very simple for my dinner, and then it's only really the last day where I go with nothing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I recommend it. That last day, nothing, but I suggest, I think apple juice or another juice, so people can have that so that the blood sugar stays up. Because you don't have the risk of like crashing from not enough blood sugar. The fasting aspect is really important, and that's all about making yourself as focused and pure as you can be, which is also about respect for those spirits and showing them that you are serious in your desire for the communication and that you are putting the energy in, that you are a person of good character. You're not lazy. Tools wise, obviously, I mean, you need the sword and the robe, and there's a few other bits and pieces, but not that much. Just simple white robe is my preference. For these things, that's the most common thing in the grimoires. It's normally a white robe. There are, as I say, bits and pieces with the tools, and I give things like, for example, a consecration of miscellaneous stuff. So, and there's consecration of jewelry. So, for example, if you have body piercings and you've got stuff, you consecrate whatever bits of metal are through your body. Because it is literally everything in that circle should be consecrated.
One thing that I did really like regarding scented things is I think the first time I read this was in one of Dr. Al Cummings's books was he recommends putting a piece of frankincense under the tongue before you begin the first conjuration.
I put that in the Grimoire Encyclopedia, and I mentioned in this book as well as a thing for, again, it's about purification of the breath and the voice. And likewise, the whole thing in your far period of fasting preparation of like not swearing, because that's degrading or demeaning the voice, which is going to speak holy words. And it is a nice thing because you are physically purifying your mouth with that. I like that. It comes from one of the German grimoires. That's like from one of the Faust books.
Nice. Yeah, I really like that. I've used that myself and I found it very useful. So to move on from that point then, what is it that you think is necessary for the practitioners to develop by themselves?
I'm a great believer that conjuration is best done in group, not a big group. Two or three is the ideal. You need minimum of two, preferably, one to conjure, and you need your seer or scryer. A scribe is nice, but the conjurer can also be the scribe. But to do all of that is really hard to keep all of that under wraps. If you actually, you're in the part where you're making your connection with the spirit and engaging with it, to then have to try and be writing stuff down or pausing to write it down and expect that spirit to just wait while you record things, etc. Keeping an eye on everything that's going on around. Yeah, I think two or three. is the ideal for doing that. And to prepare, well, I think developing your powers of concentration, meditation, visualization, things like that, I think they're still, although we don't really get that in the grimoire tradition in the past, things have evolved and the tradition is evolving. And so there's nothing wrong with adding in things that enhance and increase the magical momentum. So, for example, with the consecrations in the book, I've talked about visualizations that I do when I do consecration, so that I'm adding more to the consecration. And so being able to direct that into your words and things, it's like it builds on itself.
Snowballing.
Yeah, you snowball the conjuration, so it, and if you have to repeat the conjuration, which most times you do, it actually is stronger the second time. It's more insistent, more in it.
So my first reaction to reading your book was, wow, these appendices are great. And which I guess says something about the level of book nerd that I've become. But I think that it's really good. It really goes to show how important a lot of information is necessary, and it con all this extra information which constellates around the process of conjuration, which is so vital to the practice. Could you tell us a little bit about why you chose to lay out the book like this, with the appendices at the end in the way? Because the appendices are almost, well, I can't speak to the final version of the book, but they're almost half of the book, if not maybe more at this point.
I mean, the appendices are things like how to work out planetary hours, the actual conjurations, the prayers to the archangels, etc. So I wanted them in easily accessible, separate to the process, because the first part of the book is the preparation, all the preparation work, the consecrations. Then I lay out, like a day by day of the 7 days in the lead up, and throwing in things that might seem really obvious but need to be mentioned, like if you're going to work outdoors, to checking the long range weather forecast, stuff like this, make sure you're not going to have really awful weather that might cause you to have to abandon it. And then the whole actual step by step of everything you do, and then the bits and appendices are for working stuff out or incorporating in, like, okay, insert conjuration here, insert prayer here. So yeah, it just felt like the most efficient way to put the material so that people, could access it and work it.
Yeah, I think it's laid out in a really intuitive way, and like you said, it's all available. It's all there for you to grab right off the bat, so you can follow the step-by-step process. And if you have the book with you, at any point you've got, you can search the information at the back. You also include some like really interesting extra bits, like was it a dream divination technique as an example? Could you talk a little bit about why you chose that specific spell?
Yeah, the when as part of your magical momentum, and particularly for the person who's going to be the seer or scryer, I think you want to do anything you can to strengthen the connection with that intelligence. And back in, it was 2008 or so, but somewhere around when I did Collection of Magical Secrets, there's this technique in there for planetary angel seals and prayers that you put under your bed, under the pillow, and say this prayer to sort of like get a message from the angel at night. And I thought, this is great. You could adapt this to start developing the connection to the intelligence before the conjuration, in like in during your build-up time, and also have it there afterwards, because in case for whatever reason the conjuration doesn't succeed, because they don't always work, and who knows, intelligence might be busy, they have lives too, that through our dream state is a very effective way for spirits to engage and communicate with us, and that they might then speak to you afterwards through your dreams. And this helps facilitate that by having the that talisman under your pillow. So that technique in Collection of Magical Secrets, I really like this. And then I adapted it to the intelligences years ago. And then when I was putting the material together for the book, I found in Secret of Secrets, the text that was Cunningham's grimoire, there is this one of Tyriel. And it was exactly the way I had adapted it. And in hindsight, I wonder if, because I'd looked at that manuscript back in about 2004, and then Steve and I worked on it in what, 2017 or whenever it was, 18, 19, whether that had gone into my unconscious. And when I saw the stuff from Collection of Magical Secrets, it triggered, and I, part of me remembered and dredged out to adapt. I thought this is a, I really like this to, like I say, add to the magical momentum for developing the contact and also providing an avenue for the spirit, if the conjuration didn't work, to still engage with you and for you to communicate with the spirit.
And in many cases, I found that conjuration could appear to have fallen flat, only for the subsequent night for you to make contact with the spirit in your dreams, in your sleep, or via some other, like portents, or strange occurrences that occur after the fact. And I really like the inclusion. It's such a simple thing that you've included, but there's so much. That there's so much you could develop from that I thought it was really fascinating, really interesting. Then, especially like you said, you create a like a link in a way with the spirit. In case it doesn't show up, then you've already got that link set up there, ready to utilize and maybe even call through again. And if you do manage to make contact in dream, but not in the circle, as it were, then you can bring the object with you into the circle later and use divination to continue that conversation, as it were. So
I was trying, like I say, with the book, to try and cover every angle I could think of to try and, ensure that people would have successful conjuration. So for me, adding that in was like a must. It's something that has worked really well, I have found, and I know people have as well. So therefore, why not include it? It's anything that can increase the chance of success, increase your magical momentum, I think. It's good to put in.
what is your advice then for people who actually manage to get us to actually accomplish a successful conjuration? Because I can say from my experience that the first time it works is shocking. So there might be some people out there who might, refuse to believe that what they've experienced, or they might be terrified by what happens. But from your experience and from what you've been through in your life, what would be your advice for people who might want to try and do this, but maybe might be a bit skeptical? And then when they actually perform the sequence and they perform the ritual and they actually get a success, how do they cope? How do you recommend people cope with that?
Well, I mean, it is a life-changing moment the first time you have that spirit contact and you have that realization that spirits are unique entities separate from us that are not part of our psyches or minds that have their own existence. And it suddenly changes your perception of the whole universe around us, that there's all these spirits. So from that perspective, I think the most important thing is to be aware that it can knock you for six. But for me, probably the most important question to ask that spirit when you have that first contact is, are there things I can do next time that will make this process easier? Ask the spirit for advice. Start the process of getting taught by the spirits. Because at the end of the day, this is where this stuff came from in the past. People got a lot of stuff, I think, in grimoires and things. People contacted spirits and they were taught, the spirit said, you do this and this and this.
If we read the Testament of Solomon, the text itself is the Solomon learning how to conjure the next spirit through another spirit.
asking, what can I do to make this easier for you? Are there particular things you would like me to do? Are you happy with the fragrance? Would you like a different fragrance? And be aware that it's a two-way process, and it's a relationship that can develop. Like I said, I think if you're working with intelligence, you may work with it again in the future, and so it's good to ask that. That is, I think, the most important question.
So develop a relationship and learn preferences and learn how to engage and communicate. Focus with meditation is you recommended meditation, so to keep us keeping a sharp mind and having a partner in crime with you along the way will help.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's some very good advice, David. Thank you. So I am in awe, honestly, of your ability to create so swiftly. You've only just finished these your encyclopedias, and now you're already about to publish another book. All the while, everything in your personal life seems to have, it's been lots of things have changed there as well. So you've been so incredibly busy, and you've managed to do this. So yeah, very, very impressed. So what are you obsessed with at the moment now? Do you have any more projects that you're working on?
I've started on volume three of the Grimm Encyclopedia.
Already.
Yeah, of course. There's not usually a period where I'm not writing. I mean, that's not true. I did have a period of about 3 years, some years back, where I didn't write, but that was because in the previous period of many years before that, I'd written so many books that I needed a break. I had like a few years to allow myself to kind of come out of that so that I didn't get stale or burn out, and then restarted with Yetzirah Magic and writing about things I'm passionate about. And so, I mean, I have a whole list of ideas of projects that I would like to do at some point. And it's just a case of which one grabs me. And volume three of the Grimm Encyclopedia is what has grabbed me.
Well, I'm sure I speak for everybody when I say that we're looking forward to that as well. Could you give us a little hint, like what kind of material would be included in part three?
It's very early days, so I don't really want to talk
Okay.
much about it, because I think it's probably going to be another year or so of work on it. It's going to take me, I think. Maybe more, maybe less. We'll see how it goes along the way.
And will it be of comparable size?
Yeah.
Right. Well, looking forward to it very much. All right. Well, thank you so much, David, for coming on to the show today. I've had a really good time talking with you. I've learned a few things, and I guess I'll speak to you again next year or after that when the part three of your encyclopedia series comes out. But yes, thank you so much, David.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
That was David Rankin, author of Clavis Intelligentarum, a complete practical manual of conjuration of the planetary intelligences, which is now available on pre-order from Hadean Press, link in the description. It's always an absolute pleasure talking with David. He is such a wealth of knowledge and experience. I am always so impressed by how much he manages to produce, and the quality of his work is essentially a benchmark in modern occulture. I really enjoyed our conversation about the nature of the seals of the intelligences, their names and offices, as well as the process of creating this manual as a form of blueprint which can be developed by the magician into a proper living, breathing system. It's work like this that will help propel the grimoire revival forward, giving people the tools necessary to get in the circle and to work their magic.
it's not only the more obvious ritual steps, which I find so fascinating, but it's the small details and nuances, which are usually gems only hard won by experienced hands. And David just so compassionately passes this on to his readers. While I knew that book three of David's encyclopedia was going to happen, I was genuinely surprised to hear that he's already made a start to it. So, I mean, it will no doubt be another precious resource for many decades or even centuries to come. To those of you who have listened all the way through, I thank you from the very bottom of my heart. It means so much of us. To those of you who have listened all the way through, I thank you from the very bottom of my heart. It means so much to us that we have dedicated listeners and readers of our material. Please hit the like button and share our videos with those who might find our work interesting. We are still growing as a channel, slowly but surely, and we want to reach as wide an audience as we possibly can. There is still so much to come from Hadean Press this year, and we are really looking forward to sharing more from the leading thinkers and practitioners on the very cutting edge of a culture. Thank you all so much for your support, and I will see you all again in the next one.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.